This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Alfred Hitchcock, one of the most celebrated and prolific filmmakers of our modern times. He directed more than 50 films in six decades, mastered the art of psychological thrillers and suspense, and he meticulously crafted scenes filled with compelling visuals. Many know Hitchcock for his later works like Psycho and The Birds, but today on Movies on the Radio, we're going to take a look at the entirety of his career. Going to talk about your favorite Hitchcock films spanning from the early days in the United Kingdom to films he made in Hollywood in the last years of his life. And I'm joined by our two regular film experts, Laura Boyes, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Welcome back, Laura.
Well, thank you, Frank.
And Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State University. Hello, Marcia.
Hello, Frank.
Marcia, start us off a little bit about Alfred Hitchcock's story. He did come from Great Britain.
He did come from Great Britain, and I believe he started working designing titles for silent movies in Britain and started making films of his own in the mid-1920s. He actually worked for a little bit in Germany prior to that started making films that got increasingly Hitchcockian, which is, I have a feeling, a word that we're going to be using a lot today. Right. I mean, he's one of the directors about whom you can say something like that, because his style and his subject matter, his persona was so distinct and recognizable.
When you see his silent films, which are much more conventional in story than many of his later films, they certainly show his visual flair. They often use sound, even though it's a silent film. And then at the end of the silent era, he did The Lodger, which is a story about Jack the Ripper. And the real Hitchcock interests begin to come to the fore.
What's amazing is here's a guy who is determined to be in the film industry from the very start. He gets in at the ground floor and actually defines the industry and works, you know, straight through the 70s.
Oh, his career is incredible, and that he made so many films that were popular, successful, well-received critically, talked about, analyzed. I mean, there are very few people who have had careers like Hitchcock's.
Let's hear about one of the early ones.
Hi, my name is Anzal Narayanan. I'm from Chapel Hill. And my favorite Hitchcock movie by far is The 39 Steps from 1935, because it really established the model for the modern thriller, and it's artfully paced through to the end. My favorite scene is when the protagonist is running from the cops in the streets of London, and he ends up hiding in a hall where a political rally is going on, and he's mistaken for a local politician, and he's actually asked to give a speech, even while he's terrified that the cops are going to find him.
And I ask your candidate and all those who love their fellow men to set themselves resolutely to make this world a happier place to live in. A world where no nation plots against nation, where no neighbor plots against neighbor, where there is no persecution or hunting down, where everybody gets a square deal and a sporting chance, and where people try to help and not to hinder. A world from which suspicion and cruelty and fear have been forever banished. That is the sort of world I want. Is that the sort of world you want?
It really stands out today, even to modern audiences, as being an incredibly nightmarish scene, very Hitchcockian.
Didn't take long, did
Didn't
it?
Didn't take long. Here it is. I mean, and this is a film that's a kind of perfect example of this hybridization that Hitchcock liked. Which, this was a wrong man film, so Basically someone who is accused of doing something he didn't do. So it has the thriller detective part, but then there's also this romance, and it's a comedy. And obviously Hitchcock is having great fun with political platitudes in that scene. And so this has all of those elements that would define his career.
There's a Hitchcock blonde in it as well. Madeline Carroll, the hero is Robert Donat. And this stands up so well, there's actually a London and Broadway play in which a handful of actors play all of the parts in the film using very inspirational Hitchcockian visuals on stage.
And I think this is also a film, if you're looking for an early example in his career, of a film that uses the idea of things not being what they seem. Mm-hmm. One of the things Hitchcock is very good at is bringing his audience in and giving them knowledge that the characters don't have about what's going on, and then a series of revelations that shock the characters within the film and then also alternately the audience. And so this is a film that does that wonderfully, scene after scene after scene.
Well, it's because he talked particularly at the beginning, to Francois Truffaut in a long interview-length book, that if a bomb explodes, a bomb just explodes and the thrill is over. But if you watch somebody carrying a bomb on their lap on a bus, it creates the suspense, and that's what he was much more interested in. Modern-day filmmakers, take note.
Right.
You don't even
just blows up, right?
And you don't even have to blow. I mean, Hitchcock knew you never needed the bomb to go off. Yeah. You just needed the audience to know the bomb was there.
Talking about our favorite Hitchcock films today, a familiar name on our next clip. Laura, your own daughter talks about The Lady Vanishes.
Hi, my name is Adrian Boyes, and I'm calling from New York City. The Lady Vanishes is my favorite Hitchcock film and is one of his earliest English films. I love his early films because they have a very loose and easy energy to them, and this one is just funny. There's an early scene in the movie where we're meeting a bunch of different characters, and we meet these two men who are talking about cricket scores, and they appear again and again and again in the movie.
The Holotelli spag jumped to the sky.
Oh, but that's impossible. We haven't fixed up yet.
Hang it all. You can't expect to put the two of us up in the maid's room.
Well, don't get excited. I'll remove the maid out.
Yes, I should think so. What? What are you talking about?
Well, okay, I think I'll soon receive on the train.
Okay.
There is no eating on the train.
No eating on the
train? Yes, I mean, heating.
Oh, heating. There's no heating on the train.
Oh, that's awkward.
All right, we'll take it. Just a minute. With one condition. Mm-hmm. You have to have the maid comes to your room and remove her wardrobe.
And they have this one scene, we see them in bed together, and you assume that they're a gay couple, but you would never say that in like a 1930s stiff British movie, and it's just very, very funny.
Well, one of your daughter's favorites. How about you, Laura?
Yes, indeed. I love The Lady Vanishes. It has a great mystery at the center of it, and the romance is very jokey and funny. It was Michael Redgrave's first film, and he tells us a story about how he thought, you know, the movies were beneath him, as so many stage actors did. And, you know, he'd been told that movies is where we go to sell what we learned on the stage. But then Paul Lucas, who's also in the film, said to him, they're going to record this and people are going to see it forever, so you better put your heart into it.
Well, and we also heard a little bit of one of the things that Hitchcock likes to do, I think, is to make fun in a very gentle way of Britishness and of affectations and obsessions. And in The 39 Steps and in this film, you get a lot of that playfulness.
Do we know how well his films did in Great Britain, those early films? They were very popular, yes.
Yeah. And there are other great ones, too. The first version of The Man Who Knew Too Much and Secret Agent with John Gielgud, and both of those also starred Peter Lorre.
And as a matter of fact, I mean, The Lady Vanishes comes out in 1938, and in 1939, Hitchcock is brought to the United States by David O. Selznick to make a film called Rebecca. So they brought him to the United States because he was a big name making great movies, and they wanted to transport some of that magic to Hollywood.
Let's take him to 1943.
Hi, I'm Jeff Martin. I'm from Chicago, Illinois, and my favorite Hitchcock film is Shadow of a Doubt, 1943.
I don't want you to touch my mother. So go away, I'm warning you. Go away or I'll kill you myself.
The best scene in the film is a scene where her uncle confronts her, drags her into sort of a sleazy bar where she's never been before, and she's completely out of her element and confused and not understanding what's going on. And Joseph Cotten, who plays the uncle, delivers this monologue about how horrible the world is.
Do you know the world is a foul sty? Do you know if you ripped the fronts off houses, you'd find swine?
He's one of the only actors that could convincingly be both a family favorite uncle and a complete sociopath. It's amazing.
That's the kind of genius of Hitchcock, though. He would, everything was started out in the most ordinary, mundane, right?
Uncle Charlie. I'm so excited Uncle Charlie's here.
Well, I actually just watched this film again last week because there's a scene
so
in
good.
It that's one of my all-time favorites where he, you know, they're having a nice family dinner at the table, and all of a sudden he starts talking about all of these women that, of course, he's been murdering, and how, you know, they're fat and disgusting. And they're drinking their husband's money and eating their husband's money. And you hear Teresa Wright's voice outstage, and she says, But they're human beings, aren't they? And the camera has dollied up for a close shot, and he looks out into the audience, and his face fills the screen, and he says, are they? And it just raises the hair on the back of your neck.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny. This, I think, of the films that we're going to talk about today, and maybe in all of Hitchcock's films, this is one of the most serious. This is a menacing, dark film. It doesn't have that sense of like, oh, we're laughing so much, and there's so much humor in comparison to
this. Well, and it's a David Lynch kind of thing too, where the small town hides corruption beneath. And this was Hitchcock often said this was his favorite of his own films.
And he's often if he has critics at all, they say, well, you know, there's too many coincidences, the plots are crazy, and he just drops in these wild, zany scenes in the middle of nowhere. But that is the genius of the filmmaker, mm-hmm. right?
Who would say such a thing?
Well, there are these. You can find critics, and there aren't many of them because they've pretty quickly shouted down.
There's not that many Hitchcock haters out there that I'm aware of.
However, contemporary reviews would just sniff, oh, it's more of the same, more of the same. If you read the reviews that came out, you know, for Vertigo and Rear Window, it's like, oh, we're just so bored with these movies. Hitchcock does the same thing over and over again. It's just for the little people.
Oh,
kind
I wish
of
directors
thing.
Would do it over and over again now.
Yeah, me too. Well, the other thing that is quite incredible about Hitchcock's career is the way he became such a personality. Yeah. I mean, directors are often, you know, people don't even know what they look like, but there are very few people, I think, to this day who couldn't see an image of Hitchcock and instantly recognize him. And, of course, he made those cameo appearances in his films, which he had to increasingly move to the front of the film because people would spend so much time looking for Hitchcock. Right, so he started putting them really early on in the film.
And that was very intentional self-promotion, which shows an awareness of how a director could become a celebrity that few other directors cared about.
The State of Things presents Alfred Hitchcock today on the radio. Movies on the Radio with Marcia Gordon and Laura Boys. We're talking about those and your favorites, and you'll hear more on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today it's Movies on the Radio, talking about your favorite Hitchcock films. I'm joined by Laura Boys and Marcia Gordon. Let's start right up. We left us in 1943. We'll move up to 1948 and The Rope.
Hi, my name is Heidi Cron. I'm calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. And one of my favorite Hitchcock movies is Rope.
By what right do you dare say that there's a superior few to which you belong? By what right did you dare decide that that boy in there was inferior and therefore could be killed? Did you think you were God, Brandon? Is that what you thought when you choked the life out of him? Is that what you thought when you served food from his grave? Well, I don't know what you thought or what you are, but I know what you've done. You've murdered. You've strangled the life out of a fellow human being who could live and love as you never could.
The way that the movie is filmed, Hitchcock keeps it very interesting for the viewer and gives you the information that you need as a viewer in a way that couldn't really be done on a stage play. And so in that way, I think he makes it really interesting for the viewer and kind of keeps you moving throughout the action in spite of the fact that it's filmed only basically in one set.
Yeah, and that's we can talk about a lot of things off of this film, but
well, I think the way it's shot, what's really exceptional about it is it's done in a series of these long takes that were about 10 minutes long, and so the cuts are almost always like kind of close up on a suit, and then you have a quote unquote invisible cut, which we all see. But to pull off, that was a very kind of showboaty bravado kind of thing to do because obviously the performers have to get everything just right, otherwise you've ruined an entire take. And Jimmy Stewart, who's the voice that you heard in that scene, is one of the Hitchcock actors, right? I mean, he did like to work with these stables of actors, and a great kind of moral center in this film, passing judgment on this homosexual couple who has just committed this act of murder for intellectual purposes. And this is a great, very unusual Hitchcock film in terms of those spatial constraints.
It was also based on a real life murder case. And for a lot of people, this film is almost too disturbing. It's very insular because it is just done, you know, in one location, and the emotions are very intense.
Well, let's talk about Heidi's point that this could only be a film. I mean, I think this for me is what makes Hitchcock great. And the reason I don't watch films most of the time is because they don't do what he did, which is make a film what it could only have been a film. The camera angles, the lighting, some of the techniques he used mean that this couldn't be done in any other medium.
Yeah, and I think that Hitchcock reveled in the specificity of the medium and giving us these beautiful kind of close-ups of something that he wants us to see and using light and shadow in these expressive ways. Music, I mean, Bernard Herrmann and, you know, I mean, all of these aspects really come together for him in a way that I think is very unusual in the history of film.
And he storyboarded everything. Everything yes. was very carefully planned out from the beginning. So for him, making the film was almost an afterthought because he had planned so carefully in advance.
And famous for not yelling and losing his temper, everything was planned so well. And so, and he did all the sketches for those scenes. Pretty much it ran like clockwork. And if something went wrong, he's famous for pulling people aside and quietly kind of making adjustments to the thing.
But he expected actors to be able to do their job as well. He was not in the business of giving people motivation.
Let's go to 1951, Strangers on a Train.
Hi, my name is Rose Hollinshead. I'm from Cary, North Carolina, and one of my favorite Hitchcock movies is Strangers on a Train.
I beg your pardon. Aren't you Guy Haines? Oh, sure. I saw you blast Faraday right off the court in South Orange last season. Made the semifinals, didn't you?
Yeah.
Oh, I certainly admire people who do things. By the way, my name is Bruno. Bruno Antony.
One of the things I like most about it is the idea of duality that is set up by the two main characters. One who is a psychopath and charming, and the other who's sort of a weak but moral character. Hitchcock references a lot of doubles throughout the movie, and this crisscrossing of the characters and what changes their lives. One scene that really stands out is a scene that is toward the end of the movie where a carousel at an amusement park gets thrown out of control, and the two main characters, these two guys, Bruno and Guy, are fighting on the carousel, and something that's innocent and fun, like a carousel, becomes out of control and sort of demonic when they're fighting on it.
There it is, Strangers on a Train.
If I was going to pick my favorite Hitchcock movie, it would probably be this one. I do love that crisscross murder and the duality. And Hitchcock shows his own power in this one scene where Bruno is on his way to plant a cigarette lighter that's going to incriminate Guy for the murder that he, in fact, committed. And he drops it down a sewer grate, and you can see his hand reaching down to try to get it. And you want him to get it, and then you go, oh, wait a minute. You don't want him to get it because he's doing something right. bad, but your emotions are so completely enthralled to the director.
And as with Rope, this is a perfect murder film. I mean, this is one of the ideas that Hitchcock likes to play with a lot. And of course, there is no such thing as a perfect murder. And in this case, it has the twist of implicating someone else. And my favorite scene in this film, which is one of these visually perfect scenes, is at a tennis match. And Bruno, who's like stalking Guy's character, played by Farley Granger, is in the audience at this tennis match. Guy's the tennis player. And the entire audience is looking left, right at the tennis ball. And Bruno is just staring straight ahead. He's the only one with his eyes completely locked. And visually, it's perfect. It's terrifying. It's very funny all at the same time.
It's ominous.
Yes.
And that's what he does. He plays with those two themes that seem to me very well link, which is the duality, the sort of the opposite characters who keep crisscrossing left, right, who's in the center, and then the mistaken man, right? The mistaken identity, I didn't do it, and now I'm on the run, and I'm in the middle of both of these.
And also
forces.
The duality of man or woman's nature. You know, you never know what you would do in a particular situation. I had a doctor who once told me, don't say something you would never do, only say what you haven't done yet. So
and Hitchcock was genius at sort of at
a doctor?
Pointing
yes
I'm pointing to. Yes. We'll talk about
my
favorite. After the show. We'll have to hear more about that. But what I'm thinking is, yeah, the idea of the psychotic within is something that you left the theater. I mean, your point that I'm pulling for the bad guy, which points to the near psychosis or my ability or willingness, you know, to do the bad thing.
Willingness.
Well, and that's one of the key things that Hitchcock liked to play with is identification and those moments where you can kind of distort an audience member's morality, even if it's just for a moment. Those are brilliant when you are rooting for the person that a minute ago you were right. Like, no, don't do that. That's and that is something that every single film has, these moments of identification that are done either visually or through a kind of plot device.
Now we're moving into the part of his career that most people identify, the names of the films that come to mind whenever you say Hitchcock. Let's take a look and hear from one listener who chose Rear Window.
Hi, my name is Laura Murray. And my favorite Hitchcock movie is Rear Window. I love Rear Window because it reminds me of family and home and the heat of summer and everybody being super busy and taking time out to have fantasies.
What do you want from me? Your friend, the girl, could have turned me in. Why didn't she? What is it you want? A lot of money? I don't have any money. Say something. Say something. Tell me what you want. Can you get me that ring back?
No.
Tell her to bring it back.
I can't. The police have it by now.
My favorite scenes include scenes with the insurance company nurse when she's saying she'll wind up fat, drunk, and miserable, and you'd think this rain would have cooled things down. All it did was make the heat wet.
That was what about his ability to, you talked earlier, Laura, about the fact that he didn't really give much direction to his actors. And yet a thing that I noticed most about his films, and I think a lot of people have noticed as well, is how great the acting is, that it brought out the best in actors. And in many cases, it's some of the best stuff they've done.
Well, part of that is casting, knowing who you want in a role and how you can tailor what your vision is to an actor's persona. Because, of course, when Hitchcock was working, actors were much more typecast than they are these days. They only played a certain kind of role. Well, and one of the things about Rear Window is it also plays with another audience interaction, which is voyeurism, is the fact that you are watching somebody watch other people.
And this is Jimmy Stewart, who's got his photographer's lens kind of trained across the alley to the other apartment building while he's got a broken leg and he's not able to get up and move and go see things. And Grace Kelly and Raymond Burr basically is in this kind of silent movie across the courtyard where they're fabricating this whole or putting together this whole plot about murder. And so it brings together all those things that are about spectatorship, about watching. And this is a film that a lot of people have spoken about in very psychoanalytic and very theoretical terms, in part because it just is asking. I mean, right. Hitchcock loved Freud and loved playing with those ideas, mothers, needless to say.
Yeah, right.
But this is one that's just like a kind of great textbook case for all of those ideas about how we watch movies.
Let's hear. Oh, and, go ahead.
I was going to say this is also the beginning of an era where the costuming became very important as well in his films. He collaborated very closely with Edith Head in this era, and he wanted his actresses in certain colors and certain styles because they became a part of the whole visual feud that he was working on.
And music as well, very important, as I think was an important element in our next film. Let's listen.
Hi, my name is Alice Reese. I'm from Holly Springs in North Carolina. My favorite Hitchcock film is Vertigo.
If I'm mad, that would explain it, wouldn't it?
Madeline!
I'm not mad. I don't want to die. There's someone within me, and she says I must die.
I like Vertigo because the scenery takes me back to my childhood in California. I especially like the scenes where they are driving down to Monterey through the eucalyptus grove. That was always a favorite landmark as a child. And the scenes filmed at Mission San Juan Baptista, another of my childhood favorites.
No!
I heard voices. God have mercy.
So, yeah, this is considered by many people to be one of the greats, if not the great Hitchcock films, of course. Jimmy Stewart again. And what I like about this film is that, to me, it's so much about that line that he was so constantly exploring between investigation, obsession, love. And it just brings all of these together in this magnificent way. And I think we'd be remiss not to mention that this is also marks one of his collaborations with the great credit artist Saul Bass. Most people, when they think of Vertigo, can picture those beautiful credit, Psycho, the same thing. And so Hitchcock did work repeatedly with certain people like Herman in the world of music and Bass in the world of credits that just were part of this imprint.
I mean, he left nothing to chance, and there was nothing that went unconsidered. The credits, the music, the costumes, I mean, all these things are very important, but they got a spotlight in every one of his films, or certainly at this period.
And this is a film that when I first saw it, I liked it. But then each successive viewing, it becomes deeper and deeper and richer. And it's a film that really changes as you grow up mm-hmm. and see different things in it. And in fact, the latest Sight and Sound poll named this the greatest film of all time, supplanting Citizen Kane, which up until this point had always been considered the greatest film.
You know what's interesting? That's the second listener in a row who talked about it bringing back a sense of nostalgia. It reminded me of the place where I, and you think, well, this is the guy who takes you to the darkest places of your imagination.
That's right.
And he's always reminding you of home.
Right. Home and family and all of those things. Yeah, I think that's getting at something that is very, very much in line with that kind of psychological game playing that he liked to do.
North by Northwest.
Hi, my name is Darren Sutherland, and I'm from Raleigh, North Carolina. And my favorite Alfred Hitchcock film is North by Northwest.
Here's your man, Doctor.
Oh. What's your name?
Roger Thornhill.
Stick out your tongue and say, ah.
You better move back.
Ah! Have you been drinking?
Doctor, I am gassed.
What were you drinking?
Well, bourbon. These two fellas...
How much would you say that you drank?
What do you say?
How much would you say that you drank?
About this much.
I usually think of it as being my favorite because it combines both mystery with an espionage thriller. Those are two of my favorite genres. It's well-paced with a good balance of adventure and humor and romance, but it knows when to slow down to build suspense to make the film even more exciting.
Selling at 1,000.
The three of you together. Now that's a picture only Charles Adams could draw.
Good evening, Mr. Captain.
Before we start calling each other names, perhaps you'd better tell me yours. I haven't had the pleasure.
You disappoint me, sir.
I was just going to say that to her.
I always understood you were a pretty shrewd fellow at your job. What possessed you to come blundering in here like this? Could it be an overpowering interest in art?
Yes, the art of survival.
North by Northwest.
This is indeed one of his more humorous films, along with To Catch a Thief, which is also from this era and also stars Cary Grant. And it's a cross-country adventure that has many very famous set pieces, a seduction on a train, a chase through a cornfield, and clambering over Mount Rushmore.
And, you know, I was thinking about all of his films, and this one to me is most like a contemporary film. Of course, the contemporary ones I don't believe are as good, but in terms of it having these kind of big moments like the ones that Laura just, and the plot just kind of barreling along, so it feels very, very ahead of its time. I mean, you know, for a film that came out in 59, it feels like it could have been made yesterday
well,
to me.
Well, most contemporary filmmakers will tell you, this is my Hitchcock film and I can make, films as good as Hitchcock. And I mean, time has proven that there is only one Alfred
Hitchcock. Interesting. I mean, you talk about it being humorous, and we've talked about the psychological factors that play a huge role. But also, I mean, it's political. He talks about espionage that always makes us question who are the good guys and who are the bad guys, and uses these iconic places, the Statue of Liberty, the UN building, and Mount Rushmore in this case, as backdrops to sort of raise questions about these pillars, these monuments of our stability, and raises questions about them, I think.
Well, it's a Cold War era movie, and that was something that was percolating behind the surface of a lot of contemporary culture.
Before the break, I think we need to hit Psycho.
My name is Patricia Buchholz, and I live in Tucson, Arizona. My favorite Alfred Hitchcock movie is Psycho.
Wouldn't it be better if you put her someplace?
You mean an institution? A madhouse?
And it uses minimal violence and death as it delves into an ordinary person who ends up off the beaten path only to find someone with deep psychological problems. My favorite scene from the movie Psycho is the last scene where Norman is sitting in the detention room, and you get a little bit of a glimpse into the state of his mind as he is now his mother.
They're probably watching me. Well, let them. Let them see what kind of a person I am. I'm not even going to swat that fly. I hope they are watching. They'll see. They'll see, and they'll know, and they'll say, why, she wouldn't even harm a fly.
I want to thank Patricia for raising the phrase minimal violence and death. That's terrific.
There's only one violent stabbing scene in this film, although famously we do not see the knife penetrate the body, which is, again, this is the art of implication. And
it's in black and white as well.
Yes, and the heroine, you think who's going to be the heroine of the film, is killed off before the first half of the movie is over. I mean, Hitchcock liked to play with these rules, right? And this is a film that broke a lot of rules as it went about telling its wonderful story. And that ending, I mean, it's such a great ending because it's menacing, but it's also funny.
I mean,
who can make menace and funny like that?
And another thing that he changed, taking control of, is Psycho was one of the very first, if not the first, movies. You will not be allowed into the theater before, after this picture has begun, because until then, you paid a quarter, and you went in the middle of a movie, and you could stay all day if you wanted. It was no big deal. But he wanted you there at the beginning, and you were to leave at the end, and you were to keep your mouth shut about what you had seen.
Stay tuned. Do not leave your radios. You will not be readmitted. Movies on the Radio continues after this. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today it's Movies on the Radio, and we are featuring your favorite Hitchcock films. I'm joined by film experts Laura Boyes and Marcia Gordon. So we talked about Psycho, and the next big one, the one that everybody knows when you say Hitchcock, is The Birds.
Yeah, so one of the things that's fun to talk about in relationship to The Birds, and I don't know what film he started doing this for, but he did this wonderful trailer for The Birds that appeared in theaters leading up to it. And, he's sitting there, he's like eating a chicken, and there's all of these little bird jokes going around, and here's Hitchcock telling you about what to expect in his film. And, you see the taxidermy, and, he did it for Psycho. I mean, he just had so much fun being Alfred Hitchcock for his audiences, and he really understood what that meant. And this one, I'm sure you can find it online, has a very, very witty trailer.
Well, let's listen to this listener who made The Birds.
Hi, my name is Jane Kirsch. I live in Chapel Hill. My favorite Hitchcock movie of all time is The Birds, and I will never forget the time that I saw it. I was 16 and with a bunch of friends. And teenage girls in a scary movie is just so much fun. My most memorable scene that I remember, it's been many years, was when the birds found ways to get down the chimney.
Mitch.
That was just terrifying. It was wonderful.
Yeah, and they're birds. I mean, they're not horrifying creatures by themselves.
The special effects for this movie are so fantastic because it's a combination of different, you know, very low-tech techniques. But there were actual trained birds that he had the bird handlers throw repeatedly at Tippi Hedren until she was genuinely terrified.
Well, and the sound, I mean, you could hear it, and that the sound engineering is brilliant on this film, and the sound of the crows and the sound of these attack birds. And
because there is no music, you just hear the birds.
Yeah, and one of the things that I think is interesting about the birds, in addition to the fact, I like the way that the listener made the point about it was so fun to be scared. I mean, these are not films that you know, terrify you to the point that you can't sleep at night. Well, I shouldn't say that, maybe some people, but but usually there's laughter combined with the horror, and that's, again, a very special thing. But this is one of three Daphne du Maurier's stories that Hitchcock adapted, and I think it's a little bit unusual and interesting that someone of such a strong kind of cinematic authorial personality as Hitchcock made mostly adaptations of other people's stories. Now, he really made them his own, so they're not just, this is very different than the du Maurier story, but he was not someone who just felt like he had to tell his own story.
But it's also this theme, one way or another, the natural order of things, whether it's your suburban lifestyle and your sort of tranquil life that you're living together, or the rules of nature get broken. And when they do, it's the most terrifying thing on earth.
Well, he's telling you never to take anything for granted. And I think that's really a theme in all of his films.
Well, and this is another mother film. I mean, Lydia, the mother in this film, is a fantastic, you know, judgmental, not accepting mother. And then, of course, everything falls apart when she's being picked apart by birds.
Tippi Hedren's big break. She was an unknown. The theater, the producers, or the, I should say the studio heads, did not like Alfred Hitchcock's decision to feature an unknown in this. He took a chance on her.
Yeah, and then continued again with her in Marnie.
All right. So, well, why don't we listen to that?
Yeah, my name is Regina Williams. I'm from Durham, North Carolina. And my favorite Hitchcock movie is Marnie from 1964, starring Sean Connery and Tippi Hedren. And one of my favorite scenes from the movie is where her horse is injured. He takes a bad tumble.
Miss Mannering, this woman comes tearing in here demanding I give her a gun.
Tell this fool to give me a gun. Mario's hurt.
Marnie, wait. I'll call a vet.
There's nothing a vet can do.
We don't have a phone anyway, Miss Mannering. If the horse is hurt bad, I could give her Jack's pistol.
Hurry. Oh, hurry, please. He's suffering.
Go get the gun. I'll do it, Marnie. You wait here.
Are you still in the mood for killing?
Please, Marnie, stay out of my way. Marnie, please. You don't want me to do it, then let me go back for one of the men.
And she shoots him, and then she's just standing over him, saying, there, 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 there.
There, no, there.
It is Marnie from 1964, right?
Yeah, and this is another trope in Hitchcock's films, which we've touched on a little but not very explicitly, is the films about women who kind of need fixing by men. And this is something that you get in a lot of iterations in his film. Sometimes the men are wrong about their fixing, but most often they have a kind of more authoritative, powerful, grounded aspect to them, and they are fixing these kind of damaged or dangerous women.
And after the birds, I think people become much more divided about Hitchcock movies because they deal with some more perhaps personally intense topics that some people just don't find to be entertaining anymore.
And they become a little bit more over the top. I mean, the birds definitely has, I mean, the lovebirds, and you know, that are like leaning to the left and leaning to the right in the back of the car. And, you know, he has these moments that get a little hammy, which, you know, you either love it or you don't.
And also it's the breakdown of the production code meant that the things that he had been imagining he could now put on the screen, and maybe we don't want to know those things.
Maybe the genius was being restrained. We should all talk about his personal life at this point. We mentioned Tippi Hedren, who does credit him with giving her the confidence to take on that monumental role in The Birds, but also says that he began stalking her, made her feel very uncomfortable, and then began asking her to do things and was quite sexually explicit. She refused, and that was the end of her career, at least as long as she was under contract to him. So, I mean, we would be remiss if we didn't point out that part of the story behind the scenes.
Well, and I think we'd also be remiss if we didn't point out his long time relationship with his wife, Alma Reville, who was a screenwriter and story writer on many of his films and clearly had a hand in the Hitchcockian personality, even if she was always behind the scenes.
And in fact, I saw a silent film that she is kind of credited with directing, because the star of the movie, Miles Mander, never directed any other movie before or since. And when you see this movie, it's called The Firstborn, there are so many touches that you would describe as Hitchcockian that you have to kind of reevaluate how much her influence really shaped his filmmaking.
Well, I think whenever we say something like Hitchcockian or Wellesian or Kubrickian, I mean, we're always talking about this idea of the whole package, which is so often collaborative, even if there's this kind of dominating personality.
Well, it's always collaborative. You can't make a movie by yourself.
No, but in the old studio system, you know, the director had far more say, but you're right. And there's no way to make a film without it. Let's move into the last decade of Alfred Hitchcock's career, a clip from the 1972 film Frenzy.
Hi, my name is Fred Schwartz. I live in Raleigh. And I wanted to put in a word for the movie Frenzy. I think it's highly overlooked by people when they sit around discussing Hitchcock films.
Wake up!
What?
Get out of here!
What is it?
Brenda wasn't enough for you. You had to kill another girl, too.
What girl?
You know, all right, that girl you brought here yesterday.
Babs?
As if you didn't know. You strangled her like all the others!
It was well received by the credits when it came out about 1971 or 72. But when people sit around talking about it, it just never comes up. And I thought not only was it a little bit macabre because of the way these women were killed by being strangled with a tie, but it had some humor in it, and it's one of those movies where the audience knows who the guilty party is in the first 5 minutes, and then it takes the police 2 hours to figure it out. And you know that the police figured it out in the last sentence of the movie.
Mr. Rusk, you're not wearing your tie.
And that's when they know they got him. But in the meantime, there's the main character who's being harassed because the police think he's guilty and he's trying to prove his innocence.
Well, the murders in this film are very explicit, and I think that's something new for Hitchcock, and it's a reason that many people find it much less attractive.
Well, and let's talk about this. There's a lot of strangling and talking about strangling in Hitchcock films, and this is one of the films. This is about someone who goes around strangling women, and it's a wrong man film. It's the 39 Steps, you know, reinvented or whatever. But, I mean, Rope, Strangers on a Train. I mean, there is so much kind of talk and then kind of witnessing this particular methodology. It was clearly one that fascinated Hitchcock. I mean, to the point that in Strangers on a Train, there's that great scene where Bruno is at a cocktail party and there's this older woman who's, you know, a great Hitchcock type. And just for fun, he decides to show her how she couldn't get out of a chokehold. And he gets a little bit carried away until he ends up passed out on the floor.
But you're right. This one is creepy in the way that other films weren't. The other ones, because so much was suggested and so much was happening in your head, they didn't have this kind of creepy effect that this one does.
I disagree. I feel like Psycho is an incredible... I mean, even though you don't see a knife penetrating skin, that is an incredibly creepy scene. Woman in the shower being, you know, stabbed and bleeding out into a drain, and somebody poking, you know, peeping through a hole in the wall and keeping his dead mother upstairs.
But that's what all that stuff's, I mean, it's all happening, but those strangulation
scenes, you don't
scenes
have to
and
watch
all
them.
all of the dialogue or monologue that went on with it as he's strangling those people, that's a little, I don't know. That just sounded more like fingers on a blackboard.
Another theme certainly is also control, because everyone knows, because Hitchcock put himself forward, that he was not a very attractive-looking man, and yet he has control over all of these beautiful actresses, and he can tell them what to do. And so this is a tension that comes out in his films and in his personal life as well.
And as far as the wrong man, I mean, it's interesting that that goes so far, or at least the story is, that his father had him sent to jail as a little boy, and then he had worked a thing out with the police chief, and 5 minutes in the jail at the local constabulary was enough to make him worry about the wrong man for the rest of his career, I guess.
Well, he told that story about 100,000 times.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I've
probably not even true.
I'm not going to say
Hitchcockian.
Print the legend.
I'll take it. Here we are at the end of his career, The Family Plot.
Hi, I'm Justin White. I'm from East Greenwich, Rhode Island. And my favorite Hitchcock film is his final film, Family Plot. One of my favorite scenes from this movie is the car chase scene. A couple going down a very steep highway with lots of hairpin turns, and someone has cut their brakes. And really, you expect that it's going to be lots of reaction shots, lots of terror, lots of fright, and it's all those things. But the way Hitchcock plays it, the couple is arguing, and there's an incredible amount of physical comedy happening within the car.
George! Come on, woman, don't grab me, for God's sake. It's not me. It's the brakes don't work.
I'm getting violently ill, George.
You're choking me, Blanche, for Christ's sake.
George!
So it becomes this strange kind of nightmare farce more than anything. And again, very unexpected, very unusual.
Yeah, that is a very, very funny scene. I mean, what you can't hear in that scene is that she's like hanging off his neck. And I mean, this is some of the kind of over-the-topness. And this is, you know, Hitchcock died just a few years after making this film. And this is kind of a great zany story about kidnapping and diamonds and, you know, all of these kind of twisted plots and crisscrosses, actually, just to bring it all back to center. But it is a pretty zany film.
Actually, the last line before the crash, she's all over him, right, grabbing him, taking his tie. She's strangling him. The last line before they actually go into the ditch is, "Hold on."
Right.
Look at it. So yeah, I mean, it was a very zany.
Yeah, and I think as Justin pointed out, you think it's going to be this terrifying. You're on the edge of your seat, you know, waiting to see what happens. But it's actually this kind of this woman who's driving him nuts while he's trying to steer the car. And so, you know, it's the kind of the joke on the woman, but it's in a funny way.
I wonder if Hitchcock would have wanted this to be his final film, if he could have had his way.
We need a medium. We need to do a seance so we can find out if...
There he is.
Well, and actually, let us not forget that Hitchcock also had this huge career in television.
Yeah.
Alfred Hitchcock Presents. I mean, where he was on there, you know, shilling the Hitchcock personality and the Hitchcock story type and doing it in this shorter format that reached, you know, so many people in another way. So Hitchcock was really a very multimedia personality.
And he had branded mystery stories, you know, Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine and short story collections and so forth.
But even the TV show, The Frame, that was an ingenious frame that's never really been repeated. It wasn't just a setup. It was very much a part of the entire plot. And nothing was by chance or an afterthought, it seemed to me.
Mm-hmm.
Does his legacy survive? I mean, is there anybody, can you poke holes in that career yet?
I mean, I would have no desire to. I mean,
yeah.
Who has made this many films that people have seen and love? I mean, I don't think, I mean, we could do other shows about great directors, and we would have, you know, a lot of different call-ins, but I don't think there would be anything like the response that we got to this show in terms of the variety, and so many people have this kind of passionate favorite. I mean, I think, you know, typically even a director with a big career, you would maybe get 5 or 6 films. I mean, we could have done 10 others.
But does he have imitators, and why not?
Of course he has imitators. Yeah. Anyone who makes any sort of a thriller.
But I will argue that they don't, because they leave out all of the things that made Hitchcock films great. They don't show the time bomb on the lap. They just blow the darn thing up.
Because they think they're as good as Alfred Hitchcock, and they would be wrong.
Right. They think that they can better the master in some ways. And I do think it's worth really acknowledging that mastery, because, you know, again, there's so many great moments of laughter and terror all blended together in a Hitchcock film, and that's what makes them so great.
Well, every once in a while, the Carolina Theater will do a Hitchcock retrospective, and I'll go to see a film on the big screen I haven't seen for a while, and I'll see someone there I know, and they'll say, "I've never seen Vertigo," and I say, "You're so lucky. You're about to have the most amazing experience."
You could also have an amazing experience with The Graduate. We'll talk about that in a minute, but this is our conversation about Alfred Hitchcock, and I think it was a wonderful one. And I can't wait to be at the Hunt Library, because next month you can join our Movies on the Radio conversation, September 28th from 6:30 p.m. at the North Carolina State Hunt Library. We're going to screen the 1967 classic The Graduate, talk about why that film remains a pop culture fixture to this day. Marcia Gordon and Laura Boyes will be with me. You can be there as well. Laura is the film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Marcia Gordon is film professor at North Carolina State University. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you so much.
You can find out more about this program and how to join us next time for a screening of The Graduate September 28th at the Hunt Library at NC State by visiting our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Widarski sitting in today. Andrew Tai is our intern. Brent Wolf, WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.